Justin, you still popping them opioids?
No, I haven't had one. Okay. It depends on how you're using that. I haven't had one today.
Okay.
I want to eat one, though, like Pac-Man.
What if people don't have the context of why you're a drug addict now?
Then they should listen to my brother, and me, and advise you for the modern era, releasing every Monday on the Maximum Fun Network.
A lot of people don't understand that there's... If you're only listening to one of these podcasts, they are
half the story.
They are a codec for each other.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's only the people who listen to both that can like ferret out the like Dan Brown-esque riddle that exists in both universes.
Okay, I want to talk about Justin and his opiate addiction.
Yes, Justin got his wisdom teeth taken out.
Addiction's a big word.
He used to be addicted to having wisdom teeth.
Uh-huh.
But we staged an intervention for him. We pulled all his teeth out. Now you don't have them anymore. So
you get all four taken out in one swoop?
Yeah, I figure, fuck it, right?
In for a penny, in for a pound.
Yep.
If you're going to go to town, you might as well go into Lincoln.
Did they show you them afterwards?
Isn't that some horse shit? They didn't.
I think you have to ask specifically.
I asked specifically.
And what did they say?
I didn't ask before. But I guess, do they grind them into dust? Because they wouldn't go get them for me.
Yeah, what did they say when you asked?
We don't keep those.
Right. Well, the more I think about it, the fact that they didn't show you your teeth might indicate that there's some sort of Jurassic Park scenario taking place. They're just going to, DNA the shit out of those teeth.
Or
DNA them.
Or a dino scientist is going to carry it around in his pocket and use it to scare chubby kids that come to his excavation site. talk about what predatory Justins are capable of in the wilds. You think they're to your left, but they're not. They're behind you, and they're biting you with their back teeth.
Let's start this dumb show. My name is Justin McElroy, and I know the best game of the month.
My name is Griffin McElroy, and only like one good game came out this month, so I know what that is.
My name is Chris Plant, and I know the best game of the month.
Oof. My name is Russ Frustry, and I know the best game of the week and month.
This is the Besties, where we talk about the latest and greatest in sports, entertainment, news, previews, video games, FIFA, football, soccer. We got soccer fever here. Go USA, go. Can't wait to see how far they make it. And today we're going to talk about video games. June is a hot month.
It is. Temperature-wise, very hot.
June is a hot month, literally. But
very hot.
For video game releases, it's been like that one book I read in Rainbow about the family that didn't have a lot of money to go around. Tight times.
So they made soup out of rocks.
It's been tight times in the video game world, but we still uncovered a few gems that came out this month. Of course, with E3, the whole industry kind of loses a week because no one wants to release then, and then before that, everybody's planning for E3, so there's no games then, and then after that, everyone's still drunk. So
yeah,
I don't want to put any games out then either.
Why won't I sober up? It's been three weeks. What's wrong with my body?
Yeah, it's been bad.
E3 was exciting if you're a time traveler and you can just jump ahead to March 2015 when all this shit's going to be extant.
We kind of released a Besties. Sort of.
Sort of.
We did. If you could search that Best of E3 video polygon on Google.
It's non-canonical Besties.
If you miss our... old school, needlessly combative Besties, I would say that's a good fit for you. Because,
if you prefer blood sugar to be at its all-time low when it comes to attitudes.
Well, and if you want to see me get genuinely angry at the three other people whose voices you're hearing right now, just go ahead. I had a friend who watched that and said, man, are you putting on? I was like, no, they made me pretty angry. That was me being genuinely angry with my coworkers. Well,
that's all in the past.
Feelings are still there.
Yeah, it's all behind us. Let's talk about the games with June. kind of a mixed bag this month of games. Fresh Dick, you've got the first one that we're going to talk about, and it is the 1,000th and first Spikes game.
Yep.
Is that correct?
That is accurate. It is called 1001 Spikes. There's a subtitle involving this hero, but I don't remember the exact wording of it. 1001 Spikes is the nomenclature.
Abin Hawkins and the 1001 Spikes.
There it is. And 1001 Spikes is a platformer in the style, graphically and gameplay-wise, of like NES-era platformers, 8-bit platformers. It's very, very difficult. In addition to there being 1001 spikes in the game, actually, I'm not sure that that's true, but you do get 1001 lives, and you will probably be using every one of those lives because you'll be dying quite a bit because the game is intentionally very hard. I would say if you played Super Meat Boy, it's a pretty similar experience, although control-wise, again, it controls more like an 8-bit era game than it does like a more modern platforming game.
I'm not so sure the Super Meat Boy comparison is so on point.
It definitely 100% is.
Well, it's just like the difficulty of the game and sort of the trial and error nature of the game.
Yeah, and it's a platformer.
And it's a platformer, sure.
And it's 2D. And it's like old school inspired.
For me, like the structure of the game is what sort of set it apart. Like the idea of having like a limited number of tries looming over you. Like, how it gives the game a sort of oppressive, because in Super Meat Boy, you can fuck up and like forever and still be fine. Not when you're in those like special, like hidden stages where you only have 3 attempts to get it right. But like, it casts a specter over the game that I'll be honest, I didn't finish playing it because I got to this one area. It's the level right after the fire levels, like the lava levels. And like, I hit a wall. And I was playing on an airplane, and so, like, I spent, like, 70 tries on one level, and I was like, screw this, I'm going to do something else. And when I came back to it, I had forgotten all the stuff I had memorized about that level over my 70 tries, and I thought, like, I'm just not going to...
Yeah, you can't leave a level midway through.
You have to beat it, and that's, like, a really... I don't like playing any video game like that, whether it's, like, an RPG where, like, save points are few and far between, and I know, like, well, I've just got to... you know, get through this until it's done. Like, that's just not how I play games anymore.
Sure. Well, I'm going to throw down some topics that I think, you know, you mentioned the live thing, the limited lives. And I was a little daunted by that as well, but they actually have a mechanic where you just buy more lives. It does seem weird with money. You earn like money in the
Earth
game.
Money?
Not like real world money, but like in-game money.
I haven't found any in-game money yet. Where are you getting this money?
So, the game nests a bunch of features inside. Like, there are these, like, golden idol gem things that you find in each of the levels. Sure. If you collect, like, 5 of those, you unlock other modes that you can play that are, like, play very differently from the normal game. Like, big, much larger levels that are not as difficult and more, like... repeatable.
I played the tower.
Yeah, so in the tower game. Thing, I think it's called the Tower of Nanner, you earn money, and the money is spent in a store that unlocks once you, I think, collect a few more of those idols. So the store, in addition to having, like, you can buy a bunch of lives for some money, you can buy new characters, and one of the things that I really liked about it, which is another Super Meat Boy comparison, is that there's a bunch of unlockable characters. And they're all inspired by classic video game things. So there's like an old school, like looking like a Simon Belmont from like Castlevania 2, and he has a whip and a throwing knife.
I wasn't so crazy about the fact that each character has their own standalone like campaign path. Like if you chose to play as a different character, you couldn't keep playing on the path you're playing as Abin Hawkins because. Like, the mechanics are a little bit different, so, like, it boots you all the way back to the start.
Yeah, I think the idea was that it would encourage people to sort of have a different experience getting through each of the levels. Otherwise, like, it kind of makes speedruns meaningless, because clearly you would just pick the character that...
Yeah, and it also makes the levels more difficult to design. Like, if characters are capable of doing different things, how do you design... Like, this is a game where every pixel... of it's like the precise. Platforming challenge is considered by the by the level. So like you have to have this perfect run through it. If you all of a sudden like put in a character that can hover,
right? it changes the design entirely. Yeah, now, so that's the whole life thing and money, and I don't think the game does an extremely good job like letting people know how to unlock that extra content. I know someone at work actually played through the whole game, didn't find a single golden idol, and like all the content was still locked when he beat
Weird.
The game.
Weird, yeah.
So there's that. Why I like this game, and I totally 100% appreciate why certain people wouldn't like this style of game, is because, I mean, Griffin's right. You do have to, like, focus and, like, beat a level in one sitting. But that feeling of, like, slowly, like, getting closer and closer and closer to the ending is super satisfying. It's like, I feel like for anyone that's seen Edge of Tomorrow, that's how I feel when I play this game, because I'm just getting better and better and better. Mm-hmm. And granted, you could, like, simplify it into, like, a memorization game. But there's still, like, a lot of reflexes involved and a lot of, like,
reaction time. Oh, no, yeah, you have to have the skills to execute the moves.
Right, it's not like a fucking, like, card-matching memorization game. Like,
right.
There's
And, like, I like that. I like torture platformers. Like, I love that feeling that I get when I do complete that. But, like, yeah. I think everybody has a breaking point. And I know that these games, this genre gets, like, way crazier. Like, I've tried to play I Want to Be the Guy and Cloudberry Kingdom and shit like that. But everybody, I think, has a breaking point. And mine is, like, when I spend an hour on a single level knowing that I have to finish it or else I'll forget everything that I have memorized about that level. And then, like, I finally get through the string of, like, super difficult, like, millisecond to millisecond jumps and attacks that I have to do to get through something. And then I finally make it to the door. And then, like, a spike pops out from right under the door and kills me. I'm like, I quit. I couldn't.
See, the only reason that bothers me is because of the life count. And I mean, I know that it's a specific choice that they made, and they obviously have their reasons. For me, I could get into, like, the experimentation and the constant death thing if there wasn't just that little bit of it needing to be demoralizing every time that I died. I don't understand why every single time there has to be a little bit, like, of that negative reinforcement.
Yeah.
I think it takes away from it being just, like, a fun... It would be funny to get all the way to the end and die, kind of. Like, that's, it would be kind of funny, except every time it happens, it becomes a little less likely that you're going to be able to finish the game. I just don't really understand the reason.
They overused that idea of, like, that last second fuck you. Like, even Super Meat Boy doesn't do that. Like, sure. You see the exit, you get to Band-Aid Girl or Bandage Girl, and, like, you're done with the level. If Bandage Girl, like, no kidding, half the time in those later stages had a secret spike that shot out of the top of her head and killed you, like, that just, it's that sense of satisfaction you get when completing a level is completely overshadowed by, well, this is just fucking annoying.
Well, yeah, because that takes it from... It takes it from a skill-based thing to a memorization-based thing.
Yeah. You can usually see... I mean, you can usually see that stuff ahead of time. Usually.
I think the memorization thing is my issue with it. And I think it's funny that Fresh references Edge of Tomorrow, and this is going to be nitty-gritty because few people saw the movie and fewer people read the book. But the book that it's based off of is about the writer's issues with video games that... It's this sense of, wow, this is a crazy, impossible adventure, and I am totally outmatched. And as I play through it, I'm becoming a hero, and I'm saving the day, but really all I'm doing is learning patterns. And it doesn't mean I'm any better than the person I was when I started. And that's how I feel when I play these games, where when I complete a level or make it too far in the game, I actually feel, like, gross. I feel like I have been, almost learning choreography, but, like, not performing it for anyone but myself. Right. And then when it's done, it's like, well, why did I do that? Like, why did I learn to do this weird thing with the machine that I don't feel like I really gained anything from, other than the fact that I, like, learned how to basically mirror exactly what the developer wanted me to do.
Right. And, I mean, you could, if that... I could see a lot of people being frustrated by what you just said.
They think that's, like, all video games.
It could be, like, a lot of video games, but, like, I think in this specific case, what puts me off is, like, a lot of those later levels really do require a there's, like, a single way, really, that you can get through it. And there's a little bit of variation to it. Like, you can branch off to try and get that golden skull, which will give you an extra one up or whatever. But, like, there are levels that, like, at you start by, like, dropping into this, like, this tunnel of spikes and lava and fireballs and enemies that are, like, on a pattern that you need to, like, know. And there's just, like, the one way you can get through it. And once you get outside of that pattern, once you've started, you're dead.
Yeah, it feels to me more like reading music versus, like, Spelunky being improvisation. Because I think there are similarities to be drawn other than them both being adventures. But, like, when you look at a level in 1001 Spikes, you're looking at it as this thing that I'm going to hit these marks that have been preset. While I personally love something like Spelunky where I feel like, okay, I have a general feel for what this is. I can bring what I know to kind of survive it.
Yeah, I mean, they are, like... I mean, in terms of Griffin not agreeing with my Super Meat Boy comparison, I don't really agree. I mean, again, I get the connection to Spelunky, but they're very different.
That's why I'm saying.
Really trying to do two very, very different
things. Exactly, and that's why I like the other one. Because
also on Spikes, beyond just like, I understand where you're coming from, Chris, but for me, the benefit or like the what I get out of it is that a lot of the levels are designed with a real intelligence that is actually sort of like fun to unearth. The logic behind
it's like a puzzle game almost.
There's like one really great bit where you have to get across a gap, and there are these four platforms, and once you step on them they start falling down, and you actually have to run across the platforms, get a key, and then jump back across the platforms before they disappear completely. And the second platform you can actually completely miss as you're going, you can hop right over it as you're hopping down the key. But if you do that, then you don't start it lowering.
Yeah.
And it'll be hard to get back. You won't be able to get back over. Like, so you have to, as part of the procedure, make sure you touch that second one or else it won't.
Yeah, I like those things. And I shouldn't say that there's nothing for me in these games. I think the pleasure of games like this that are so specific is that you're essentially learning to think like the developer. And I think puzzle games is a similar example. I think adventure games, too, where you're learning how they think. And it's almost like you're predicting, they have a sense of humor about killing me off at the last possible second. I should always be prepared for traps at that door.
Yeah.
And you start to think like they want you to think. And I think there's something, I mean, kind of cool about developing that kind of bond with a designer through the game. I just personally... I mean, it's a matter of taste. I just don't always connect.
For me, like, I recognize I'm just bellyaching because, like, I liked the game a lot. And I liked learning and, like, specifically learning that language that the developer invented. And then you have to figure out how to do it in order to survive. Like, I really was into that. It's just, like, it reached a point. I feel like it got so wildly unbalanced towards the end where... It almost felt like they knowingly were like shaving off huge portions of the people who were playing the game with every like set of levels that came around, because like you'll play a set of levels and be like, that was super fucking hard, and then the next set of levels is like always twice as difficult.
Well, you should also note that at the end of the game that you see on the campaign may not really be the end of the game.
Okay. Well, I didn't even reach that end is what I'm saying. Like, I hit a wall, and like I thought I was good at the game, and I thought like I had learned how to survive in this super punishing world. And then like I think I started one of the new set of levels and like bashed my head against the wall in like the first one, and I was just like, no, I guess this is just where we part ways, old friend. And that was like kind of disappointing to me.
This is a small thing, but I really don't like the two different jump heights.
Oh, I love that.
I think that's really cool.
I don't get it. I think that makes me very angry.
I'd much rather that than like an analog control of the jump height, because it lets them make essentially a very, very precise platformer.
Right.
Why can't you tap versus hold? Like, what?
Because it's not... I'd rather like know for 100% sure what height my jump is going to be.
Right. No, I dig that a lot.
There were just too many deaths that, like...
If you'd done a different jump.
If I'd used a different jump, and I didn't even think... And honestly, that's something that I ran into a few times. And tell me, maybe this might have just been my experience. There are a few things that seem like, for a game that's so much about precision and being pixel perfect, there were some things that seemed like kind of sketchy to me. Like there were times when like flames would shoot out of the wall, and I would be positive that the flames had been like extinguished, and I'd still catch fire. Like I was certain that I wasn't touching them. There was sometimes also with like jumping underneath blocks. Falling blocks where I feel like I cleared it and they still killed me like repeatedly.
There was a little bit of that for me. Whenever you're on like blocks that are moving, like sometimes if that block like touches a wall that is higher than it, it doesn't even give you like a millisecond to try and jump up to that higher platform. It just knocks you right off like underneath the block into the lava right next to you. Like I had a little bit of that, but I thought for the most part it was a pretty tight.
Yeah, I didn't have a ton of that either. Maybe once or twice here and there, but not repeatedly. I really liked it, but I also get why people wouldn't really. It is for a very, very specific.
Did you all
kind
play
of
on right. Vita, or did you play on?
Okay. Yeah, on Vita. Vita, I thought was a fantastic platform for
it. I wouldn't play it on anything. I wouldn't like. It's a good game to like bring with you on a bus or a train or something where you're going to be playing something for an hour. If I were playing it on a TV, then I would not only like be strapping myself into this experience that you have to play in huge chunks if you want to get ahead. I would be like anchoring myself to my television. And like,
so
that
the only reason to play on a TV is that it actually is easier, obviously, to do co-op.
Yeah,
which is cool.
Sure, but I didn't mess with that at all. I feel bad because I like my opinion of the game. I understand is not. I don't think like based on. It's not qualitative at all. It's just like I was disappointed. I like a hard game, but I was disappointed at how like fucking bananas it got close to the end. And if that's, I mean, that's what they were going for, obviously. Like nobody, there aren't many developers making games that hard. So I guess good on them. I was bummed out that I couldn't hang. Maybe that's a me problem. Maybe that's not an it problem.
Griffin, speaking of games with problems, we got another game here that doesn't have real graphics, and I was wondering if you could tell us about it.
Oh, God. I thought you had gotten over that.
No.
No. This is a really good game. I actually am willing to ignore it for. This is, like, I never get warm fuzzies from, like, a retro style of games. This one did it for me. I don't know if it's the semblance to Link to the Legend of Zelda 2 or what it was, but this one actually did trigger some sort of nostalgia.
We're talking about Shovel Knight. It might be my game of the year so far. I know Dark Souls 2 came out, and that was a really good
high.
One. Well, maybe it's just because it's more recent. Shovel Knight, it is a retro-style platformer that and when I say retro style, it kind of sets the bar for what that idea can be, because while it takes a lot of really cool like mechanical ideas from games like DuckTales for NES and Mega Man and Zelda, Zelda 2 I should say, it takes those mechanics, but it makes it entirely its own, and then it presents a retro experience that feels authentic. And the way that it feels authentic is by nailing all that shit, nailing a lot of, like, unquantifiable, like, things about NES games that we loved and, like, still love, like world design and just sort of the tone of the game. And it's not, like, just drenched with shitty, like, referential humor. And, like, that cocktail really, really does make it feel like an NES class. I feel like that's a trope of criticizing like retro games. Like it just feels like an NES game that never got released, but it actually totally does feel like a game.
Yeah,
from
it
that
actually
era that was really good.
Works within the restraints, which is I think the difference between those games. I mean, one, you say it's not referential, but two, like it looks like limited number of animations. Like when a character does something, the color palette looks like the actual NES color palette. Like it looks. Very restrained, not like, well, they're using pixels, but really...
Yeah.
But the where they actually cheat a little bit for the better is in the controls. Like, if you go back and play any of those old NES games, they do not control nearly as well as you think they do. But Shovel Knight, the way like he moves around and stuff like that, feels like much more modern, much more like a typical like a platformer that you'd play these days than you would back in the NES days. That's where I think this becomes much more palatable than, say, like the re-release of DuckTales, which was really pretty atrocious to play through because it faithfully recreated the like stiff, jerky controls of the original.
I
wanted to point out, Griffin, you had said that this feels like an NES game that didn't get released, and the only thing I would challenge in that is that the it shows how like not just graphics have evolved in video game design. Like, this actually couldn't have been released in the NES era because there are ideas in it and like concepts that are more recent ideas that are being appropriated. Like the best one I can think of is the death mechanic, where if you die in Shovel Knight, you die in real life. No, if you die in Shovel Knight, you lose a certain amount of your money, and it turns into like bags of cash that are just sort of like floating, and you have to make it back to the point you died and recollect your cash to get the money back.
Yeah,
which is.
Which you get Dark one Souls. Shot. You get one shot to do.
You get one shot at it. It's Dark Souls. I mean, it's a Dark Souls. It is an idea that we saw implemented in Dark Souls that is being like scaled back to a retro aesthetic.
Yeah.
That's like that's a heady.
I think even smarter than that is how they've handled checkpoints. Which I realize they did a big blog post about how they handle checkpoints on their blog. It's Yacht Club is the name of the developer. Where like they, it was a really difficult subject for them to approach because checkpoints have become a very forgiving system in modern games. Whether you want to call like auto saving a checkpoint or whatever, they are much closer and much more forgiving than they were back in the NES era. There's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, you could argue that we are becoming soft as game consumers. But it was also like, that's how they padded out the length of NES games back in the day, is by making you play through the same stuff over and over again because it was really hard, and when you died and failed, most of the time you had to start completely over. So how do they like do that while also maintaining like an accessibility for the game? And the way they do that is by making
so
all the checkpoints
elegant, smart.
It's so fucking good. They make all the checkpoints in the game breakable. And when you break them, you get money out of them. So you can get bigger rewards from a level, but if you die and you broke that checkpoint, you have to go back to the one before it. So you could break all the checkpoints in a level, and if you die, you have to start totally over, which puts you way further away from the loot that you dropped when you died.
And if you die on the way back, you lose all the money from that level, and there's no way to get it back unless
you restart. It offers all the challenge. It offers... a bonus for people who want to ratchet up
variable,
the difficulty.
A variable bonus. Each section of the game is not as difficult as the other, and so like maybe a checkpoint's worth like 500 gold, maybe a checkpoint is worth like 2,500 gold because you're about to face like a fucking super hard platforming challenge.
And it does that all in the context of the game, which I think is the most impressive thing about it. Like, none of it is in a menu. It is completely like you're making this decision on the fly. Now, that being said, if you, like myself, did have occasions where you accidentally broke the checkpoint globe,
bummer,
not intending to, that is a bitter pill. That is
okay, but if you did that, they also talked about that. Like, how can we prevent dummies like Justin from drooling all over himself while playing the game? It's they made it so you had to hit the checkpoint three times. So, like, if you
but if you're auto bouncing.
If you do that three times, though?
If it's a low... There were a couple of places where it was a low ceiling. So it was hard to... It just happened.
How many opiates were you on?
Yeah. were you on...
Some, now that I think about it.
Daddy's special tooth medicine. Yeah, they didn't factor that in. Maybe that should be an option. Are you on Daddy's special tooth medicine? And if you hit yes on the main menu, then maybe it takes 30 bounces to break them.
Work.
It might work, yeah. I just, like... It was actually kind of a tough game to review because, like, trying to explain how they, like, made a retro game that feels authentic was really tough to do, because I think everybody who makes a retro game tries to make it authentic. Like, that is the pitch of those games. Like, they don't make them like they used to. And I think that that idea is a lot more difficult to explain than just, like, the graphics look like they did in the, like, late 80s, early 90s. Well, like, there's a feel to those games that is really, really, really hard to reproduce. And they have managed to do that.
Saying that it ends up being this, like, you know, the Nintendo game you've always wanted turned me off to it. Like, I got around to playing it because, you know, obviously we're talking about it here. But that has been done poorly so many times, and I've heard that praise lobbed and then been kind of disappointed so many times that I was expecting it to be like, oh, here's just another, like, generic platformer, bash things, get to the end, go to the next level. And there's just so much more depth to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I really do think there's something to be said for the fact that a lot of those kinds of games try to, like, win easy points with fans of retro games by, like, having a character in there who says, I am error, or it's dangerous to go alone, take this, or, like, I'm a plumber and so is my brother. Like, Shovel Knight really doesn't do any of that, and because of that, it doesn't feel like like, I think in the review I used the term love letter. Like, it doesn't feel like a, hey, you guys remember this? It feels like the thing that you remembered. Like, it feels, there is one level, actually, that I loved and was willing to give it credit for. There's one level that is a mansion of, it's called the Hall of Champions. And it's like a playable level with a kind of a cool, like, ghost hunting mechanic in it. And in the background are pictures of people who helped kickstart the game, like big donors, got their actual, like, pixel portraits in the game. And there are characters in there who constantly make these awesome Kickstarter jokes, like, I guess this will teach me to pay for something before I get it, which is pretty great. But other than that, it is like, I don't know.
It reminds me of is where I'd put it in the pantheon of heroes is right next to Rogue Legacy. I think that's another example of, like, a retro aesthetic, both, like, visually and just sort of ethically retro, but with, like, some modern ideas of, like, having a roguelike and what that means, that feels like it could have been of a certain time period without being too, like, winky,
yeah,
referential, which I hate.
And I also think that Shovel Knight, like, created this world, like, both through presentation, the music in the game is incredible, but also, like, the characters, there's a giant half fish, half apple called the Troupel King that will do a special dance for you, and then he spits out his own body fluids that you can drink as a potion. There's a goat mathematician that
I love the goat mathematician.
Is a goatician, and he sells you meal tickets that you give to the cook who gives you special food that increases your health. There's, like, a moody witch that hangs out in a basement that you, like, give $100 to, and then she gives you, like, a potion minigame thing. Like, the world feel, like, I can remember all that shit. Like, I can remember all of, like, these, what would otherwise be throwaway characters, but I remember them because they had, like, this identity in this crazy world where, yeah, human-animal hybrids existed, and, like, there was a town called, like, Armor Outpost, and it's where you got your armor upgraded. Like, I love that shit. Like, it is a simplicity that, like, those old NES games had, and it's the reason we remember them is because of that, like, charming simplicity. And they like, nailed it.
Yeah, willingness to be, like, really weird.
Really super weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really
dig it. It's a shame it's not on Mac. I had to play it at work for a little bit, and really enjoyed what I played at work, but it's not on Mac yet. I know it's coming there.
My only qualm with the game was that the economy of it was a bit rough, because they do have all these cool systems, like the checkpoint system and the death system, and you're constantly, like, scouring each level for hidden areas that you can find more money in, because there's a lot of stuff to buy. But I managed to purchase every upgrade in the game with, like two-thirds of the way through the game. And then the rest of it, I realized, like, how important those systems were, because I stopped, like, giving a shit about them, because I really had no need for money anymore. Like, yeah, I would just throw myself into a level and die and be like, well, whatever, I wasn't going to use that money anyway.
Yeah, it's tricky there, because it's like, you don't know whether to design for like the super crazy gold collecting maniac or like a more casual player.
It just feels like they meant to make a more long form experience, because you can play New Game Plus, which I did. Right. I've almost finished my second playthrough of the game, and there's not any new stuff really to buy in New Game Plus. And so like your New Game Plus run, like you don't have that impetus at all. And that's a huge
bummer. Right, so you're just going for the exit.
There's also like it feels like they have perfected what they have put in there, but it feels like there should be more in there. Like they are going to update the game because there's some Kickstarter stretch goal rewards that they just haven't implemented yet, like the multiplayer battle mode and the extra playable characters. Like it feels like it needs that stuff. And I mean, they'll get there. It's just kind of a bummer that it wasn't there at launch.
Yeah,
but if you haven't played it, seriously, pick it up. It is.
It's on the Wii U.
It's on Wii U. It's on 3DS. It's on PC.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious how 3DS goes. I know they said that it wouldn't have the multiplayer battle mode, but I mean that doesn't exist yet, anyways.
I'm playing on 3DS.
Oh, is it? I enjoyed it. Is it good? Okay. Well, just find out.
I mean, I the only thing I don't like, neither the thumbstick nor the D-pad are like particularly satisfying. I've been making it work with the D-pad, but it's, you know, neither of those control methods are particularly feel great for a retro style game like this.
It bums me out that it's not on Vita, because I just love that D-pad on Vita.
It'd be great.
That's a good D-pad. Trish, play it on something. It really is. I'll say it's my second favorite game of the year so far, which really surprised the hell out of me. Like I did not think this was going to be the game that would, like, I was in sort of a post E3 funk, and this game pulled me like right out of it.
Griffin, you played it on PC?
Played it on PC, yeah.
Does it support the PS4 controller natively?
Oh, I don't know. I have a wired 360 controller that I use
la-di-da.
For just almost, well, I mean, it's like $25.
La-di-da.
It's like $25.
Yeah, it's really good, though. I agree. Should we do some post E3 feelings?
Yes.
How do we feel? Yes.
Do we have this?
We do. Do we have feelings?
Actually, E3 robs your feelings. It takes your feelings and it turns them into explosions and muscles.
I did feel a little bit deadened by the end of the week.
It was. Let's be fair. I feel bad because I feel like I didn't see this. This is every E3, by the way. But I feel like I didn't see the shit that everybody was talking about. Like, everybody was talking about how dope Evolve is, and it looks dope. But I just didn't play it, and I think you need to do that to see it.
Oh, man. That makes me sad.
Bloodborne?
Oh, yeah.
Looks dope, but I didn't get to see that presentation. The only, I spent most of my time playing Wii U stuff, which was cool. Everything I played on the Wii U was really great, but it just, kind of made me more sad that the Wii U's not doing better, and I'm, completely unsure if whether, you know, this stuff is going to be the stuff to do it, which I'm not going to get in that conversation again, because it's the conversation that made me so angry with the three of you.
Yeah, we don't need to go into, specific game feelings. I was more wondering how you guys felt overall about E3,
I spend the time after E3 not being too deep into video games, because I feel like I need it. Normally I would start getting excited for the rest of the year. That's what E3 does for me. This one and I know that probably sounds weird to people who don't work in the industry, but when you deal with something every single day and it's sort of like you're the first thing you're talking and thinking about when you wake up, and the last thing, blah blah blah, when you stop working, you can get a little. I'll get a little mechanical. You know, you lose that sense of fun that you used to get from playing video games. And usually, what E3 does is it kind of, or it has for me, is say hey, this stuff's just around the corner, and this is new, exciting things going on that you can get invigorated about for the future, and here's cool stuff. And there was definitely some of that at E3, but a lot of it wasn't going to happen this year. As a result, I found the whole thing a little demoralizing. It didn't really amp me up the way I was hoping for.
That is a bummer. For me, it was two things that sort of got my spirits down. I don't think they're down as a whole, because I really did play some exciting shit, and I am looking forward to a bunch of stuff. But the first big thing was that We got shit we've been working on for a long time that is nowhere close to ready. Like, EA's press conference as a whole, like, made me pretty pissed off for that exact reason of, like, we've been working on Mass Effect for a while, and here is some concept art. We've been working on Mirror's Edge 2 for a while, and here's, like, 6 seconds of gameplay footage. This time, things will be red when you need to interact with them. Like, thanks. Thank you. That is how stuff happened. But I think the other thing is, like, I think the other big thing is just, like, there weren't that many surprises. Like, there were a few games that we didn't know about, but there just wasn't, like, at the end of the week, the stuff that you saw that turned out to be cool, you kind of, like, I thought Evolve was going to be cool already, and, like, outside of the new Rainbow Six game, which I think we all expected, I mean, we expected Patriots probably to...
I didn't expect it to be as good as it was, that Rainbow Six game.
That was a nice surprise, for sure.
That was a nice surprise, but,
and
like...
And I thought No Man's Sky, like...
No Man's Sky, but, like, cool, but we knew that was going to be cool. The Division looks really cool. That looked cool last time I saw it, too. The surprises were a bit smaller, like the fact that they finally showed off Dragon Age, and guess what? It actually looks pretty fucking tight. I was ready to write that game off because they've been playing it so close to the vest, and like it seemed like they were trying to bury it a little bit, which was weird. So that's a relief that is shaping up to be all right. But like,
I think it's fair to say that it was a safe year. Like, it didn't feel like a lot of companies took risks, and that's sort of what you'd expect, you know, in this like where we are in the console cycle. Like, new consoles are launching, they don't want to risk like screwing up a franchise at the dawn of a console cycle. But yeah, it makes covering it a little less thrilling because there really aren't very many surprises.
I think my big bummer with it is I'm now pretty much convinced they know how to market a game through E3 perfectly. Like, they know the marketing people and the PR teams and just the publishers in general have mastered the E3 demo, and that I'm like happy to be excited by the stuff I see at these presentations, but I feel like it's like almost an entirely different thing than the game that we will end up reviewing. And I think Watch Dogs is like a pretty perfect example of that.
Yeah,
And I think we've already begun to see and kind of hear about changes with what the Division will be, and EA's entire thing was just promises. I mean, it's like it'll be the thing that you want it to be.
Not for every scenario, obviously. Like, for example, granted, it won't play out exactly like it was during the demo, but I think Far Cry 4 will play pretty like.
It'll play like Far Cry. Sure.
It'll play like Far Cry.
But
like,
no, I'm not saying that they're all bad. I'm not saying that this means
you're saying that they're staged to a certain
extent. Yeah, well, not just that they're staged, but they know exactly what to hit. They know how to make the special sauce. And I think that's what both feels. It's weird because like these games, on one hand, I'm excited about them, but on the other hand, it's like eating McDonald's all week, where it's like, this tastes good, but I don't really feel like I'm gaining anything.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the only way to show those games.
Not
during
true.
E3.
Do you know my best moment of E3? My highlight of E3 was the Smash Brothers Invitational. That represented like Nintendo's strategy, like, went so far against what everybody else was doing. Of that, like, here's a pre-prepared package that we're going to show like 20 people 40 different times during the show, or we're just going to like show them the same shit that we showed during our press conference because this is our message. Yay. Nintendo was like, fuck that. Like, we've been working on this game for a long time. People probably know what they're getting into with a Smash Brothers game. It's at a point where it's pretty good. Let's just, like, have 1,000 people play it for 13
hours. Okay, but Nintendo wasn't the only people that did that. Consider if EA hadn't had Battlefield leak, how crazy it would have been on the stage to be like, hey, the new Battlefield game, go home and play it today.
Go home and play it. Or come to this
rooftop. Would have been, like, insane. So I think that, like, if especially with the EA press conference, the reason it fell a little flat is because they were really planning for that to be their like headline, and
it's the trouble with only having one thing.
But that's like, that was just the one, like, Nintendo on their like booth space on the show floor. And I know that now this is only germane to people who were at E3, but like, that's where I was. Like, they announced games that they would then let you play for a long time down on the show. Like, Splatoon was out on the show floor. Mario Maker was out on the show floor. The new Kirby Canvas Curse game, or Rainbow Curse, which, like, holy shit, I can't believe that's actually a thing that's coming.
Yeah. That, you know what? That was a surprise. that E3 delivered. That was good.
Yeah, good job. Like, Nintendo did a lot of, like, seriously, all the stuff I played was really great. And
I'm
then
probably
not
being
only
unfair, by the way, in the regard with, like, respect to Nintendo. Nintendo had probably the highest percentage of surprises there. But just to take you folks behind the curtain a little bit, the way that came about was that Nintendo actually let press watch the Nintendo Direct the day before.
The night before.
The night before, right. So as fun as it might have been for you to see New Zelda and to see Kirby, imagine it is, I guarantee you, it is substantially less fun just getting it dictated to you by a harried Brian Crescente. It is slightly less enthusing when delivered.
Maybe,
in
but
that,
like
in
we,
that medium.
We didn't all, that was like two of us that actually got to see it, like actually watching.
No, I got
the
it worse. I got it just dictated to me by Brian. I didn't get to watch
well,
it.
Also,
at all.
I don't know if you know this, but it's like, yeah, and there's a new Zelda, and you don't believe in it. Maybe and she's got a bow. Yeah, and don't worry about it. And there might be some Kirby stuff. Go ask Mike.
Go ask Mike. He watched. Yeah.
I still don't know. Like, I think Nintendo had those surprises like that. If there was one thing that left me excited, it was that idea that there are some really good games coming to this platform that like I was totally ready to write off, and now I'm like excited that I have one again. I just don't know if it's enough.
I think that it's just the latest indicator, and there have been a lot of these. I think it's just the latest indicator that the things that are going to be really exciting about the video game space are not going to be coming from people who are going to E3. That's not where the cool stuff's going to show up. That's not where the exciting games are going to show up. That's not where the surprises are going to come from. I feel like it's getting increasingly sort of antiquated.
Where are they going to come then?
From the underground, from the people who aren't paying for booths, from the people who...
Yeah, but even in like mid-range budget stuff, it's happening
that's
on PC.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well,
and
PC
is not represented
in
E3.
No, yeah.
I don't know. I think there's still like I don't know. That's the thing. I don't know. I didn't play like that new Rainbow Six game. Like I didn't play like a lot of the shit that people came away from the show talking about how
okay,
sweet
but, like,
it was.
Okay, but like think about the things that have excited you over the past 6 months maybe about video games, right? Very few I here's a few that like I know that I've gotten excited about. Rust was very cool. Shovel Knight, just to use like a more recent example. That Dark Room game that I played, Bounden, is another cool one. Like, and none of those did I hear about from E3. It's coming completely from word of mouth and like bubbling up from people's blogs and Twitter feeds and whatever. It's just not like next year. I would be surprised if we sent nearly as many people. You're already seeing outlets scale way back on the number of people.
Yeah, but we'll have to send twice as many people because every game next year will be a multiplayer game. There will not be a single thing
that is left
to be single player.
If anything, this E3 has made me realize that I should stop using E3, and I think we all should, stop using E3 as a barometer for where games are. Like, I used to treat it like that. I used to treat it like, oh, man, nothing's come out. Yeah, like, nothing's come out in the last, like, couple months that's got me really excited. I really need something to, like, show me that games are, like, what to look forward to, like, get me, like, psyched about where games are at. And I don't know that, like, as diverse as gaming platforms are becoming, and as, like, as many game developers are sort of, like, spreading their seed out there, like, I don't know that E3 is, like, it can do that to a certain extent, but I don't know that it's the end-all, be-all
anymore.
Zoe
Quinn is working on an FMV game, like, starring Greg Sestero. Like,
what?
Sorry, E3. Yes, Griffin. So, like, sorry, E3, you have a long way to go before you're nearly as
that's
excited
great.
As that.
I will say that I spent one of my, like, better, like, few hours I spent at E3 was actually at the little, like, weird Devolver Village, which was, like, around the corner from our studio where we were shooting all of our video stuff. Where I got to play like Hotline Miami 2, which is hot as shit. I got to play that Titan Souls game.
That game is really good.
That game is so, so good. If you guys didn't see the video we did where we had them come in and play it with us, it's a, like a demade Shadow of the Colossus. They were also showing off like a pigeon dating game.
Like, yeah, that, it was definitely that, that Devolver parking lot felt like an Alterna E3.
And they also had like a little Indiecade like area in one of the halls. I will say it was like the quietest E3 I've ever been to, both in terms of like actual volume and also like there were huge chunks of the like halls where there was just like
that's
really
also
anything.
Like pulling back the curtain on that. They've decided basically to move all the demos inside a booth now, I guess to control who can see things or just how crowded and busy things get, or, you know, maybe to optimize the experience. But it was, I was shocked how few things were actually out and available on the floor for people to play. For the most part, yeah. You had to talk to PR and go behind some
Sony had
doors.
A ton of demos.
Sony,
I mean,
like
Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo are always going to have that.
And sure. Sony's show floor was almost entirely indie games. Like they had Sony show floor was like a huge open area with like these long rows of like open rooms sort of surrounding it, and those rooms would be like the, you know, Little Big Planet 3, which I can't believe I've forgotten to mention that up to this point. Looks pretty tight. And you know, they had like a Bloodborne booth, and they had a one for the Killzone DLC. Like they had their like first party stuff there, but most of the actual like exposed show floor area of their booth, which was humongous, was just rows and rows and rows of indie games, like Jamestown Plus, and they had a bunch of Minecraft, which I felt bad because nobody was playing it, because it's like, it's Minecraft, guys, we got it. But they also had like Helldivers,
just
like a bunch of stations.
Binding of Isaac on Vita.
Binding of Isaac on Vita, like a bunch of like, that was pretty refreshing to me.
Just yeah. To put a pin in this, I don't want people to think that we're like, I think a lot of times being jaded about E3 can come off as being jaded about video games.
The exact
like,
opposite.
I don't feel that way at all. Like, video games are awesome. There's so many crazy, weird, oddball, like, video games that are being made and released by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 person teams. Like, I am not in any way, like, down on video games. And it is solely about E3, and I know that if you're somebody who's like always wanted to go to E3 or something, that may come off as like, I don't know, like gross, cynical, jaded journo stuff, but just from my perspective, the exciting things that are happening aren't happening there right now to me, for me personally.
I still think there's definitely you could've said as much.
I mean, like you can apologize for it, but like that's not the, and the show may get to that point, but like that's not the show it is.
It all comes down to like, I think if you're one person covering the show, you can fill your schedule the entire week with seeing nothing but cool shit. It's just the nature of how we like, and most outlets cover this thing is we send a bunch of people and then you get, you know, different things. So you get like a pretty wide array of stuff. And it felt like this year you had to work just a little bit harder to like, A, find like playable shit, because there were a lot of like theater presentations, hands-off stuff for games that are coming out in like October, and also to like find stuff that got you like just excited. So like I don't know that it's hard to talk about, because you're talking about like the entire like ecosystem of E3, because there was definitely cool shit to see. But it's just like the entire bubble felt a little more insubstantial.
Cool.
Cool, cool, cool.
Is there not any news that we can talk about?
No, I mean, E3 was the news section, which is fine. There hasn't been anything.
Let's talk about this fucking Hearthstone thing.
All right, yeah, we can talk about that.
There's this Finnish tournament led by the Finnish Assembly that is only allowing entrance in the Hearthstone tournament to dudes. And here is the reason, is that the original reason that the head admin of the Assembly Summer 2014 Hearthstone qualifier told the publication, in accordance with the IESF tournament regulations, since the main tournament event is open to male players only, this is to avoid possible conflicts, e.g., a female player eliminating a male player during round of eight, among other things.
What does that even mean?
What are you talking about?
Apparently, if a female player beat a male player, there would be outrage and tables flipped, and people would just question why they're even alive at this point.
That's the dumbest and worst.
They have separate... I was also reading this, so there's separate tournaments for male and female, which is crazy to me.
Right, because like, when a female wins the female tournament, there's not, like, another female, like, tournament on the ladder higher up for them to move up to, is there? And for the men, for that case, like...
Why is it even separated?
So here's the thing. I think this is stupid and dumb and wrong. There's precedence for it.
Stupid, wrong shit also.
No. There's precedence for it in the world of chess. And in the world of chess, there aren't many women players. And so the rise of female leagues in chess has largely been to
promote growth. Sure.
Growth and like put more of a focus on women players. The difference being the key difference, I think, and the one that like is so sort of sketchy in this case is that it doesn't preclude women from participating in chess tournaments. That I think is when you...
So essentially there's a women's only tournament, but there's no men's only tournament.
Correct. Right. Which, I mean, sure. Let's be honest, sounds like a kind of an imbalance for us dudes, huh?
Oh, God.
Right?
Jesus, please.
It's a satire.
It's just parody.
It's a parody of those. It does suck. And this is so stupid. Like, even if you're not, like, even you have to be pretty deep down the MRA rabbit hole to not see that this is ridiculous, right?
And like, it's also Finland, which I thought was a pretty, like...
I thought we were cool.
I thought they were a cool group.
I thought we were buds.
Yeah, I guess I don't want to judge all of Finland based on one.
But I will watch me do it.
Tournament. but it's outlandish.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah, there was a time actually I remember historically when Finland was in the grips of war.
Okay.
If only there was a game to recreate that moment.
Oh boy, heavy.
I don't know if Finland was in World War I.
They were probably involved in some way.
It was the World War, Justin. We were all soldiers.
We were all involved
that,
in different ways. Valiant Hearts is a game about the First World War. And it is a war game in which you are not explicitly tasked with killing people. Which makes it very different from many war games.
Many games.
Also, not... True. You kill quite a few people pretty early.
I said you're not specifically
right.
tasked.
If you happen to kill people in your travails, so be it.
When do you kill people?
Like, what about that time at the very beginning when you blow up a bridge full of people on it?
They run away.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they go to great lengths to show
you
specifically.
So it's like the Lego
Like, even
games.
When you blow up a tower or whatever, it shows the people, like, jumping out of the tower. I'm not saying that you never kill people, but, like,
sure.
That's not the main thrust of the game.
That mostly. Almost seems disingenuous. Like,
okay.
To make it like a cartoon.
It would maybe, like, just talk about the game.
Yeah, sorry. I'm being a jerk.
So you play... It's sort of a branching narrative that tells a few different stories in parallel, and by and large, the people that are profiled in Valiant Hearts aren't war heroes, per se, in the traditional sense that we think of them. They seem to be sort of everyday people that are bringing their own baggage to the war and their own reasons for being there, telling their own stories. And the game is mainly told through sort of a puzzle mechanic, similar to like what you'd seen in an adventure game. Where you find, you know, the right item to use in a specific scenario, interspersed with, like, some more arcadey-type bits. It is so, I think, refreshing to play a game that... We have so many games that glorify violence, and it for me, is really refreshing to see a game that deals with war in a sort of very human way. One of the most interesting things... about the game for me, and I think this is a real your mileage may vary, not everybody be into this. There are, in each level, there are facts that pop up that you can read interspersed with each of the levels that provide, like, actual historical context about what you're doing and the area that you're in, like, what the reality of the war was like for people in that time period. And as such, I think I feel like playing Valiant Hearts gives me a better idea of, like, what the actual experience of being in this war was like, so much better than in a first-person shooter where I'm basically just, you know, mowing down the bad guys or whatever.
More so even, I think, than Assassin's Creed, which does sort of a similar thing with, like, if you come across, like, a famous building or they talk about, like, a famous person that actually existed during that era. I never read that supplemental information because, like, it's just not super interesting to me. What Valiant Hearts does is it breaks it down into, like, topics. So it will talk about, like trench warfare, like what that was like. It talks about chlorine gas and how it was utilized and, like, the crazy shit that soldiers did to survive getting bombed by chlorine gas, like peeing on rags and tying it around their faces.
Yeah, like, it's interesting. It's almost like a museum exhibit, but rather than, like, a diorama or a video that's playing alongside of things, like, the game is the AV component. Because you're actually, like, experiencing chlorine gas, for example, and, like, right, what its effects are.
And I learned shit, which I'm not sure I'm comfortable with.
Yeah.
But I got, like, actual brain smarts put in my head in a way
that's called edutainment.
I enjoyed. Yeah, but it didn't, like,
it's, I don't know, clearly labeled.
It's dangerous. Information is dangerous.
I felt the same way about Oregon Trail 30 years ago.
Well, how do you say the name of that state again?
Oregon.
Okay.
Like Polygon?
Sure.
Yeah, I agree with everything you've said. I would note also, though, with all that in mind, I don't think it's a very good game, quote-unquote game, like, as a standalone, like, if you took all the historical stuff out of it. I mean, it's interesting, like, I was really digging learning stuff, but as an adventure game, I don't think it really pushes any boundaries. It's pretty straightforward.
I don't agree at all. I think that it does some really clever stuff. Like, if you think about it as almost like a side-scroller adventure game, which is what it is, you don't have, like, a full plane that you can move around on. You have a very limited, like, scope to do everything in. And so, with that in mind, you would think that, like, the solutions to the puzzles would be very difficult, but actually it just sort of broadens what an adventure game puzzle can be. A lot of it, it comes down to, like, the interpretation of symbols, whether that is, like, there's no, like, written dialogue in the game. You'll just see, like, a speech bubble pop up with some sort of symbol in it, and then you have to sort of identify
it's like a blimp, a picture of a blimp or, like, a wine bottle. It's pretty obvious.
Not always. Like, there's one puzzle where you have to toss a guy dynamite, and there's different numbers of dynamite bundles. Has, like, his symbols are just, like, he'll just say the number 232, and you have no idea what that means. But you're on, like, a pretty limited 2D plane. Like, everything you need is in eyesight. There's no, like, obtuse solution waiting for you. It just comes down to deciphering what the game wants from you in any given situation. I like that a lot more than some more recent adventure games that have come out that do adhere to that, like, give the rubber chicken to the pilot. And
yeah, I don't think that's certainly not something I'm applauding either. Like, I'm not looking for super vague, like,
no, I'm just saying that this is a way for them to get around it. And I thought it was a really clever system that made the game, like, super accessible for me.
Sure.
I'm so mixed on the game. There's a lot I really like. I like what Justin talked about with the historical facts. It reminded me of another game that I think most of us liked, which was Call of Juarez Gunslinger. Mm-hmm. Which had these, like, bits of information pop up or be discoverable throughout the game. But what I liked about that game is it kind of drew a line between the fiction of the game and these bits of information that you were finding, where it's like, hey, everything you're doing is wacky, but here's the real deal. Here's what really went down. And what I kept running up against with this game was the issue of tone, where I didn't know what I was supposed to be feeling. That, like, it's a goofy cartoon, and, like, you guys are describing, they go out of the way for people not to die, but at the same time, like, then there'll be a bombing and you'll see like the entire background littered with dead bodies.
Or even like the puzzles. So like,
finding the bone.
Early on, there's the moment where it's like you escape from a bombing, you're a POW, you've got a big spoon, you're like digging through the ground with the big spoon, avoiding like unexploded shells in like a 2D space. And it just felt kind of goofy in comparison to like, obviously, realities of war. So it's a weird dichotomy where it's like they want to tell these true stories of these true people, but also it becomes like this outlandish, like, not realistic.
But why not?
That's
why
interesting
not
though,
do
because
that?
Like, I don't think that it's less. Is that actually less true to war than Call of Duty is? I mean, is that actually like a worse representation?
So I think this is a much better representation. I like seeing people experimenting and like doing these things. I think it is more of like we're in the growing pain stages of. Okay, we want to make games about real serious things. We have very minimal experience doing that. How do we do that without having the goal be shoot as many people in the face? And how do we get tone right in a video game? Because, you know, you're playing, and how do we make sure that, you know, who's the audience with this game? You mentioned that it felt kind of like a museum exhibit, and I think that's pretty dead on, because it feels like something I would see at, like, almost like a children's museum that is trying to explain, like, a very, very serious topic, like World War One. To a really young audience that might have trouble dealing with the complexities of it. And I think that's great. Like, from that angle, it actually makes me appreciate the game more. I think the other problem for me, though, is I don't feel like people are designers are always finding a gameplay hook that matches the actual idea or the setting. And I think, like, throwing a gun at it has been the solution for a long time for most developers. And I think right after that is the throwing kind of puzzles that, if you stripped away the setting, could be in any game. Right. What I look at, like, that game coming out about My Own War, or whatever it's called, about the people who are civilians during a war that I think is happening in, like, Eastern Europe. The idea of using, like, tower defense basically as a representation of, we have to go get resources, and then we have to protect ourselves when we're home at night. Like, that feels like a match. I get why those two are connected, but I don't always understand why the puzzles exist in this game other than having something to do.
I think a lot of them are based around, like, giving the characters identity, right? Like, the Freddy guy, the American big, like, beef tank fellow, is almost always about, like, blowing shit up and knocking shit down, while the other characters have their, like, areas of expertise. And I think that stuff lends itself to, like, some really great and, like, surprisingly super fast character development. By, like, level 2, you are, like, the plight of these characters are so, like, established at that point.
Well,
like,
not if you're Chris Plant, who had some trouble following story.
Which one?
You were like, wait, no, that guy's French. Why is he on the German
side?
No, that
was at the very beginning when I was trying not to make you feel bad, because I come from a French heritage and you come from a German heritage, and we all know.
It's an interesting point about the tone, Plant, because you know what takeaway, like, what I got from it was a lot of our best fiction about war has highlighted the absurdities of it. I'm thinking here specifically of like Catch 22, for example, or
Slaughterhouse 5 as well.
Slaughterhouse 5 is another example of, like, the most honest representation of war is probably not, like, the high wattage action of Call of Duty. But it is also not completely sorrowful, and it's not like Papers, Please. You know, it's probably something closer to absurdity, like, because it is the layering of these very absurd things that are hard for humans to process, like the death of millions of people and things like that. And I think having an absurd tone is not all that far off from representing warfare.
Oh, I agree. Do you think this game has an absurd tone? I never got that. I think it's playing pretty straight.
I mean,
like, I think it has
taking holes with a giant spoon, and there is a puzzle where you have to make hot dogs.
Yeah, but I don't think that. I honestly don't think when they were doing that, they were like, oh, this is a real yuckster. I think it was like, you're making food and it's a cartoon.
I don't know that absurdity has absurd to doesn't elicit yuckster. Yucks. It just, well,
I
like, guess
I don't think that was intentional. I think it entirely was. I think it was just meant to be banal.
I think so much of the game is like, look at these people doing this like either weird or like totally everyday shit on a battleground where millions and millions of people are dying. That isn't necessarily humorous as much as it is like it establishes a different tone that I don't think any video game has ever really used when broaching the subject, you know?
Oh, I agree. I think there's a pretty significant difference between Catch-22 or Dr. Strangelove and like what they're going for.
I think it is not especially helpful to like take any one of the game's mechanics and stripping it out and saying like, well, why did they do it this way? Because like, you can't just take the educational element and say, well, that, why did they do this, and take the puzzles and say, why did they do that? Like, it is a comprehensive package. And I think it's so like wildly original in almost every sense, both in like presentation, how they've used the UbiArt framework, how they have like adapted the like puzzle adventure game to a side-scrolling 2D idea, but also like how they talk about like the situations that war puts you in. Like it's a bundle. It's like a whole thing, and I think it's really, really successful with all the parts, you know, working together.
And it does, you know, World War One is a reason why it has never really been hit upon in games for the most part. It's a pretty awful war. It's not what you would quote unquote call a fun war.
No, that which is game, to say, like, the shooting game would be like you hiding in a trench and like shitting on yourself.
Right, exactly. Which and, is like, why there haven't really been any World War One war games.
Well, also, it's incredibly complex, and the US's involvement in it is hazy for most people.
Yeah, okay. Again, I'm talking about like as the, you know, potential gameplay mechanics. But this does do two things rather well, which is teaches you something and makes you feel engaged with the events that were going on for a period of time that I think most people aren't super familiar with. So overall, I think it's a pretty impressive feat.
I think it's very good. I think it's fair to recognize that in terms of video games that are trying to do these things, we are at the early stages. And there's a reason this is the first one that's doing it. And that's why I'm being critical, because we can compare it, and some people will say we can't, but against what other memes have done with these topics, and we are at early stages. But it's very exciting. I will take a million of, you know, shots like this over more shooters.
And it's not because those are necessary. It's not because those are necessarily bad. It's just like we've done them. It's almost only what we've done.
Yeah. And on top of it, I don't feel like there is a lot of ambition in terms of the topics that are being covered anymore by shooters. So on top of us having seen a million of them, it's not a place that I go to for a deep look and a thorough explanation of the history of World War One.
Sure. Go to my grandpa for that, my pop-pops.
Pop-pop.
Tell me about him.
My pop-pop was in the Pixel Junk Wars.
There were so many fluid dynamics, I could hardly keep track.
Oh, boy. Guys, you want to hear about Pixel Junk Shooter?
Yeah, do it.
Super, yeah, I remember playing
edition. Don't be a snob about it. I'm not gonna, I like this game.
Okay, so I don't know why I'm talking about this.
I know what you're
Fresh
wondering
tell
home.
You about how great
why
it is.
Are we talking about Pixel Junk
okay, so
Shooter again? It came out 130 years ago.
Pixel Junk Shooter came out a long, long time
it's
ago.
It's in Valiant Hearts.
I
they play it in Valiant. You see a kid with a stick playing Pixel Junk Shooter.
I'm Valiant Arts. Je m'appelle Pixel Junk. It is a 2D shooter. You fly around this world, though. I guess your character is 3D now, and there's real fluids. Gross.
But, are there?
Yeah, but anyway, you like shoot little monster things, and you save humans, and you use fluids to get through the space. It's a very fun arcadey type of game. And there's also Pixel Junk 2, which is included in the package, and that's kind of the same, but also has these like 2D auto scrolling stages. And Freshick likes it a lot. It came out a long time ago. It's a little bit better now, but you can play it on PlayStation Vita, which is what I recommend, because like 1001 Spikes, it's one of those things that you might get frustrated with at times, and the best place to play a game like that is on a long commute.
Okay, I'm going to talk about why I asked this.
Yeah, because you demanded that this game
I demanded it.
Not that there was
the multiplayer
ton of competition.
Yeah, okay.
We had some difficulty. The reason I asked for it to be included, and Plant didn't play enough of the multiplayer to really comment, but there is a multiplayer mode that I think is one of the most original multiplayer modes that I've played in a long time. It's asynchronous. It's sort of a stealth soccer blend, or capture the flag blend, where like there's two ships and you've got like a cone of vision when you're on defense, and if you spot the other guy,
did you mean asymmetrical earlier?
What?
You said asynchronous, and there's no way that's right.
Oh, did I say asynchronous? I meant asymmetrical. Sorry. Too many A's. It's very difficult to put to words, but it's an incredibly well-made, thoughtful multiplayer mode that I think has been all but ignored, even by people that like downloaded this game and played a ton of it, just because like a lot of people, you know, this co-op and the campaign and stuff like that, and that's enough for people. They don't really want an adversarial multiplayer game, but this they just made like a really creative, like dual screen. Just like each player is seeing very different
basically
things.
There's one map, and the person who is hunting
it's 1v1,
is trying to stop the
mention.
Person from getting humans, and the person who is being hunted is invisible until they're in a cone of vision, and they grab humans and try to throw them in their goal. And each character has like a few special weapons, like the ability to invert the direction of the other player's controls.
Oh, that's neat.
It's
or
neat.
Like change water to lava, or have like homing rockets. There's like a ton of different upgrades you can buy. The learning curve is like not super friendly, just because it's pretty complicated.
Is this new to Ultimate?
No, actually, it was in.
Is any of this new?
No, the graphics are new. It looks very pretty.
Okay.
It was in Pixel Junk Shooter 2, but it was wholly ignored in Pixel Junk Shooter 2. Hardly anyone played it. So this seems like a good opportunity.
That proud tradition with this iteration.
No, I've actually been playing it a lot more now that it's on Vita, which I think is where I want to play basically everything nowadays. But
yeah,
we can't talk about like Tomodachi Life or Wildstar or
you could talk about then Resties. You can like we have plenty of. I'm sure other people love those games, and we're going to talk about them there. I just wanted to like call attention to this mode that I thought was really cool. That clearly no one else thinks is cool. So
can you play it online?
Yes, it's an online. Actually, it has to be online because if it was split
screen,
that
makes sense. Yeah, you could see
you
the
would
other
see the
too.
Other person's screen.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, go for it. Just find
you can
one
actually
other
play
human
it.
That is playing this game, and you're off to the races.
You could actually play it with one person on Vita and the other person on PS4.
Oh, that's cool.
In the same room, they just can't be looking at the big screen.
And it was PlayStation Plus, right? But that's over.
Well, yeah, not anymore. As of today, it's out.
Fucking
so,
Tower Falls up on that though.
Tower Falls up next. So,
Can we just spend like some time talking about those two other games? Let's do like a mini wrap up that will include.
Why don't we do Resties?
Pixel Junk.
Guys, listen, don't turn to Resties for savior. They all say pixels. They all say no. Just kidding. Shovel Knight.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Everybody says Shovel Knight.
Okay.
A few others. Jake said he likes Action Button's new Vita game, Tuffy the Corgi, and the Tower of Bones. It's really great deconstruction of the basic platform mechanic of turning around in midair. It's a rad little game. Jeremy likes Sniper Elite 3 because he's a broken person deep down inside. He said it's fun to shoot dudes in the face in slow-mo. Jeremy, get help. Michael says his favorite game of the month isn't technically a game. It's the Resogun Heroes expansion. Completely.
Oh yeah, that's really neat.
An exciting
cool.
title gave me an opportunity to give the developers some well-deserved money. And Demolition Motors is deceptively deep strategic experience that I can't stop playing. And finally, Christopher says, it would be more relevant for May, but it's close enough. I've been playing the Star Citizen's first real playable demo. The Arena Commander module. Not really a full game, but the first piece of playable tech and the biggest crowdfunded game ever. I think it's pretty newsworthy. Did you get any of you guys back it or had a chance to play with it? Anybody?
No.
Talk about it. That's about as far as I get.
I'm excited, but I want to wait until it's more substantial. This one part might be pretty cool, but like I don't want to. I'll get burnt out if I just like every time something comes out, I play it extensively, and then when the full game launches, I'm like, well, I don't want to play that. I already spent hours and hours dipping into that. You know,
I'm curious myself. Whether I'm going to enjoy it as much if I don't play it with a flight yoke.
I don't know. You better get yourself a yoke, bro.
I gotta find my yoke again.
Get yourself a Mad Cat's yoke. I'm going to talk about Tomodachi Life in Wildstar, and you guys can come along with me if you want.
Okay.
But have any of you played Tomodachi Life?
No.
Nobody. Wildstar? Juice, I know you got it. Did you play it?
Wildstar.
I played a little bit.
Okay. Of those two, Wildstar is the one that I'm going to probably continue to play. Tomodachi Life it's like a simple, wacky life sim, and I think it was sort of pitched when it came to the States as, if you like Animal Crossing, you'll like this, which is, I believe, pretty wrong on every conceivable level, because while Animal Crossing had that hook of like crazy amounts of customization for yourself, your town, you had like total agency over the world, and it was very compelling to like find a new table because of like how it would help you create a theme for your house. Like that stuff was so compelling. Tomodachi Life doesn't really have any of that. It is mainly just like a way for you to put yourself and your friends into wacky situations, like me and Justin and Travis and a monster I made named Gordon Krampus started a hip hop group, and we would do a hip hop cover of Seal's Kiss from a Rose. Like that stuff was really great, and it's really entertaining, and it was really funny whenever stuff like that, or like there, like hundreds of weird events, like you stalking somebody in town for no reason, is really funny when stuff like that happens. But like I haven't really played it that much after I finish my review, because it doesn't have those hooks, and I think a sim game needs to have those.
What does Tomodachi mean?
Means friend in Japanese.
Friend life,
yeah, sure.
I think. What does Tamagotchi mean?
That means virtual friend who poops. Virtual friend who does poop. That's great. Wildstar is so good. I have a hard time talking about it because like I want to pitch it to people who don't play MMOs, but it is the most MMO-ass MMO probably ever.
Well, the combat, I think, is the thing that set it.
Combat's really cool. It is sort of like a hybrid between the action ideal that games like Neverwinter and there were games before. Elder Scrolls, sure, where it feels more like an action game. But it falls somewhere between that and World of Warcraft, where you have like cooldowns and hotbars and stuff like that. Where
isn't that weird that there's cooldowns on the hotbar?
Yeah, it's weird.
It's like the BLT of game mechanics.
But it feels like combat feels really satisfying. Every attack is telegraphed by this like big red field on the ground, so you have like a way of getting out of the way, which makes things move with like a really crazy fast pace from even like early on. Like that is the idea of like telegraphs and big like fights is usually saved for like end game stuff in MMOs, and this is like from the very beginning. It's something you have to like learn how to do. But I mean, like, character customization is really great. The world is enormous and really interesting. Like, all the areas have very unique feelings. And there's also, like, the best player housing system, like, ever.
I played Star Wars Galaxies.
No, it's
pretty good.
It's way, way better than
that. I had an R2-D2. Did you?
An R2-D2? No, I didn't pick that one up.
That's what his friends
call. Like you can play as an architect, and you can play like you can pick up like a wood cutting job, and then like go around cutting down trees, so you can go to your crafting station and then make a chair that you can like scale. You can make it an enormous chair or a little chair, and then drop that in your plot that you can customize with like a garden or a farm. You can do farming and then cook that stuff up in an oven that you've placed in your area. You can like change every single element that you can put in the house to like totally remix it. So I can make like a rope fence, and instead of using it as a fence, I can make it huge and like make it like a
remix.
You can make it like a big rope that hangs from the wall. Like, you have so much freedom to do stuff. There was a Penny Arcade posted one, like somebody that they knew took all the furniture and made it really little and made a dollhouse inside of their house with like real furniture that they just shrank down. And it has like an effect on your character. Like, it increases your experience gains if you like chill in your house that you have stuff in. It can give you like temporary buffs. Like, it's a really, really addicting, really clever system.
Let me talk to you about MMOs. Like, the impression that I get as someone that played an MMO for 6 months, World of Warcraft, back in 2000, blah, 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 I feel like you can't play an MMO and play other games. Do you think that's true or false?
I mean, it is definitely, they're definitely time sinks. If you want to think about it in terms of like raw hours that you put into a game, then sure. Like, when I was, I think it can be a game that you only play.
Yeah.
Just because of the content and the like grinding and the loot cycles that exist in basically every MMO, like, it can be the only game that you play. Yes.
Also, I think friends, if you are playing with people or you start at the same time as people,
yeah,
that can be a huge motivator.
That can be a really big draw.
Yeah.
But I think any MMO you can play and play other stuff as long as you are like responsible about it. Like, I think like WildStar, I've been taking like a 2 week break from checking out other stuff, but I can pretty easily hop in. One of the things that WildStar does that like a World of Warcraft doesn't is in WoW, you can have like 5 hotbars stacked on top of each other with like 40 abilities on it that you have to like remember what they are and how you use them in combat, especially in like a raid scenario where like millisecond to millisecond you have to know which abilities to use or else everybody will die and get angry at you. Like, that's a really stressful situation that requires you to memorize everything you're capable of. In WildStar, you can only have like 8 abilities active at any given time. So you have to like specialize, but there's never like any confusion as to like what you can do. You know what you can do. You know how you specialize. You can switch those out at any time, but when you're like in a big fight, you got just the 8. So there's like, you don't really have to spend a lot of time memorizing it. And it makes it a lot easier to spend time away from the game and then come back to it, because like you don't have to re-memorize this giant workstation of buttons that you don't know what they mean anymore. I've been really, really, really enjoying my time with the game. And it's the first MMO I've played probably since WoW. I got kind of into Neverwinter that I could see myself playing for some time now.
Not on Mac.
What is? Do you not own a gaming PC?
I do not own a gaming PC.
What? Okay.
I thought that was long established.
Yeah.
I guess I just forgotten.
Isn't this coming to PS4?
WildStar?
Am I? Yeah, no. Am I completely?
No, there's no
place to do it. That would be the only thing that could maybe get me into an MMO is playing it on console. I feel like that...
Elder Scrolls Online is still...
Or even like Vita. An MMO on Vita I would get into.
I mean, you can remote play, like, you can remote play Final Fantasy 14.
Yeah, that's true.
No, I think that could work. Because you have like a pretty limited slate of actions. Like, you don't have to have a bunch of stuff.
And I just want to be chatting. I don't want to type. It's like work. Mavis Beaton, screw you.
Mavis Beacon? Come on, say words right.
Anyway.
Sorry, I took a bunch of opiates before.
That's the whole show. I think we talked about everything. It's a light month. And listen, guys, July's not going to be any better. If you got any ideas for stuff we should talk about.
No, July, I have an idea. Why don't we do the thing that I was talking about earlier? I think that's a great idea.
I forget what your thing was.
Where we all pick a classic game that person has not played yet and then bring it to the table.
Because the whole point with this new format is that we'd all played everything.
Yeah, but theoretically, if it's that class of a game, other people will have played it. So, for example, Chris Plant's never played Super Metroid. Of course, I've played Super Metroid.
I played it now. I played a level.
No, he still hasn't played it.
Now,
You know what Chris Plant hasn't played that might be actually really good is Elaine Noire.
Not or really. Resident Evil 4. How about we just do a month of games I haven't played?
Yeah, let's do the Chris Plant, you should be ashamed of yourself episode.
That's
Resident Evil fucking 4.
L.A. Noire.
I beat Resident Evil 5. I think that'd be fascinating. Okay.
You know what, L.A. Noire, I've been playing it again.
Yeah.
Man, that is such a smart game. It does not get enough credit for how innovative it was with like the way it strips away mechanics and like makes a lot of stuff. It rethinks a lot of things in a way that makes sense for modern mechanics. Is an incredibly smart game that made some incredibly bad choices along the way.
There is some stuff I want to talk about, that Divinity Original Sin game. I've only put like 30 minutes into it, but it seems pretty promising.
Maybe I can finally talk about Wolf Among Us.
Since the last episode. When does 5 come out?
It'll be out this month.
My god. Okay, I haven't played it since episode 1, so I gotta...
Yeah, I got some catching up to do, too.
Well, that could be a good topic.
There'll be stuff. Let's not worry about
it. We're halfway there.
There'll be like a Spin Tires somewhere in there.
Sure.
A Spin Tires equivalent. Should we have talked about Spin Tires?
So we're the besties. You can email us, besties@polygon.com. We have a lot more content on the website. Videos and blog posts. Got
everything. If you wanted more about E3, check out our Best of E3 video. Just type in Best of E3.
Just Polygon. Type I mentioned in E3, earlier, Best of E3.
It'll come up.
You'll see it. And there's a lot more there, so please go to polygon.com, click on everything. Follow us on Twitter, give us a review or a subscription in iTunes. We really appreciate that, if you can. And make sure you join us again next month for the Besties, because shouldn't the world's best friends pick the world's best games?
Besties!